The Tom Woods Show, episode 658.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Sort of a quickie episode today. I want to make you familiar with a really great book. It's called Why Peace? It's a collection of essays by various people, all of whom are extremely interesting. And we're going to talk about exactly why and all the sorts of ground that's covered in this book in just a minute. Mark Gutman is the editor of this book, Why Peace? And Mark is actually a physician who is also a libertarian and who wrote a put together a collection similar to this one before this called Why Liberty, where he collected a bunch of responses from people. And now he's got this book, Why Peace? I just love it. And I wanted to have him on. It's hard to have a discussion about a book with, I don't know, maybe 70 or 80 pieces in it. But I just want you to know about it. And I thought we'd have a quick little conversation about it. So, Mark, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
The book is Why Peace? I just got done telling people about it. Turns out your previous book was Why Liberty? You'd think I would have started with that, but I came across Why Peace. I think somebody sent me an email about it and said, look at this great book. What kind of an idiot are you not having – well, I'm embellishing the story a little bit. What kind of an idiot are you not having this guy on? And then I looked at the – I didn't know about your other book, or I didn't remember it. I didn't associate it with your name. And I started looking through the table of contents because I thought, okay, if the person is on the left, which most people writing a book called Why Peace would be, I just want to know that so I'm prepared and I ask the right questions. And I started looking through the table of contents, and there were some people I'd never heard of. And then I saw – Karen Kotowski, Phil Giraldi, I saw David Henderson, I saw Christopher Coyne, and these are all people, by the way, I've had on the show. Every one of those I've had on the show. I thought, now hold on just a cotton pick a minute. I've had some experience with people on the left, and generally they wouldn't have these people in their book, even though they agree with them. So I thought, okay, hold on a minute. This guy's a libertarian. How about that? So my sense is that you drew, actually, even though I recognize some libertarian names, you drew from a variety of perspectives. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. There are people from – well, there's plenty of people without any kind of political leanings but or not actionable. But there are plenty of people from the right, the left, libertarian, who all talk about the common themes, just the anti-state aggression philosophy.
How is it that you came to do a project like this? You are a practicing physician. Are you in Florida?
No, I'm in Connecticut now.
Oh, you're in Connecticut now. Okay, so that's old information. Okay. Okay. Well, actually, I have a lot of friends in Connecticut. All right. Anyway, so you're doing that for a living, but you're somebody who's a libertarian, and on the side, you wanted to do this project. So you went to a public – I mean, where do you even start? And then did you solicit these pieces, or are some of them I know are reprints, but some look original?
Yeah, most of them are original. There are some reprints that have been updated. So I started, like you said, with the first book, Why Liberty, because I kind of wanted to shine a light on the liberty movement and different people around the world that were endeavoring towards, you know, peace and freedom. But then, you know, after 9/11, the way things shook out, I thought it was the most important – you know, I really wanted to shine light on state aggression, particularly the military interventions and police state abuses, because they really – to me, have always seemed to have been the largest threats to human wellness, prosperity, and happiness throughout the world. And I wanted the book to be an education because, unfortunately, I think many people are misinformed, they're uninformed, and will often tacitly consent or even promote these policies. And so I thought the best way to do it was to, you know, to ask the knowledgeable people, not myself. I'm not writing the book. I'm contacting these people, the victims, witnesses, even oftentimes in the book, perpetrators of these interventions from around the world and from several generations to tell their stories. And it came together. I mean, the stories in the book are very compelling and eye-opening. It came together tremendously, I think. And the responses I've had from people have been pretty excited.
Let me ask you about some specific – I mean, this is a huge book. This thing is huge. And if you could just look at the table of contents – I'm telling you, if you just look at the table of contents of Why Peace, you would be totally sold on this book because it's got all kinds of different angles on the question. It's got, we might call, victim stories, people who actually suffered during these wars. It's got soldier stories. It's got stories from intelligence officials. It's got stories. It's got pieces by economists talking about the economic ramifications of war, that war is not actually stimulus. It is so comprehensive. It would be, even if you didn't read every single entry, which I think you'd probably want to, what a resource this thing is to have. Instead of having to, you know, yeah, you can try and track everything down on Google the rest of your life and drive yourself crazy, or you can have this nice collection with everything you'd want to know in it. Let's start talking about Phil Giraldi. I've had Phil on the show before. He's ex-CIA, counterterrorism expert, and he's basically taken a Ron Paulian non-interventionist position, certainly since 9/11, but possibly before then. And he has a very, very moving piece in your book. Tell us about that.
He does. So you're right. He did start, well, he started from a perspective where he was a counterterrorism specialist in the U.S. government, and discusses in the book how he started from the standpoint of believing in U.S. government hegemony around the world as a vehicle for peace. But then I think it was really post 9/11. He talks about how he was watching the Iraq war unfold, and he discusses a moment where he's at his kitchen table and his grandson is eating a bowl of cereal next to him. He develops it very nicely, and he's reading the paper and he sees a image in the newspaper of a Iraqi boy who has been killed by, you know, a U.S. government bombed out building. And he's again looking at his grandson and realizes that this war was a big mistake, and compounding it to other thoughts he's been having, and then looking forward just how U.S. military intervention around the world has not been a positive force always, and not in the net, and that we're creating a lot of enemies and a lot of blowback. And then he also talks about how people responded to the newspaper complaining about this photo, saying that it's going to increase anti-Americanism and prevent people from supporting the war. And he says, you know, what kind of monsters have we become that we're not going to report on the horrible, you know, ramifications of our actions and not, you know, be responsible for them?
And, you know, of course, I've had the same kind of experiences myself back in the 90s. In the early 90s, there were the there was the Persian Gulf War, and I was a college undergraduate at the time, and I don't recall, because I wasn't really looking for them, frankly. I was a rah 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 flag waving cheerleader for the whole thing, so I wasn't going out of my way to look for casualties, civilian casualties or anything. But I did hear stories of people who were soldiers who were retreating and who were being mowed down anyway. And I thought, well, even though they're soldiers, and that means that technically, according to the rules of war, their lives don't count. They don't really matter because they're fair game. I thought, but, you know, the probably their families were depending on those people. You know, there are a lot of widows now. There are a lot of orphans now. And I just found it hard to celebrate that. I thought, I just can't wrap my head around the fact that I'm supposed to put up yellow ribbons and I'm supposed to cheer and be excited about this. I thought, this is just a terrible tragedy. The less said about it, the better. And at that time, I was a total GOP cheerleader. But even I started – now, I cauterized the wound and I moved on. I didn't let this change my mind for another few years. But I did have something, you know, somewhat analogous to this Phil Giraldi experience. And that, more than any talk about U.S. interests and, well, this maybe this is or is not in U.S. interests, it's the human consequences of this and the callousness that it creates in the invading party that is the really, really significant thing to me. Now you yourself, were you always a libertarian?
No, pretty early on, when I was just starting to vote, I voted for Bill Clinton in 92, but only the first time. By the time the second time rolled around, I was pretty firmly in the libertarian camp. I had started traveling overseas around then. I spent 6 months hitchhiking through Africa and was really I'd graduated college. I was outside the rigors of school and study, and I was free, just hitchhiking, living in my tent and feeling pretty liberated. But at the same time, the backdrop of that were the Africans I was around, who would talk to me about trying to start businesses or some kind of entrepreneurial thing, and all the regulations and red tape and bribery they had to go through, and just all the restrictions on them and all the fear of government they had in Africa. And then I came back to the States, and that's when they started doing, I was visiting California, and they had the smoking ban in bars. And I said, this is so strange. This is private property. And they're saying that people can't smoke in bars, and they want us to go outside to the public spaces and smoke. Now, I wasn't a smoker, but I just thought it was strange. So then I started having these budding ideas, and my brother said, well, you should read some Harry Brown.
Oh, yeah, you're a goner once you read Harry Brown.
Yeah, and he totally reoriented me. Like, I had this whole kind of idea of, like you were saying earlier about, and what we were saying about Phil, about how, you know, we thought that the U.S. Constitution and the U.S. government was this beacon of liberty and freedom for the world. And it just took me time to kind of break down some of the veils of the U.S. government military actions throughout, you know, a couple of centuries, and how it wasn't always largely for good, and oftentimes it was for self-interest or corporate interests, or who knows what sometimes. And he really kind of made me understand some of the other ways to see these policy decisions.
Let's talk about I was reading a testimony, I'm sorry, I don't remember the name, in your book about it was somebody who, you know, who had roots both in the U.S. and had family both in the U.S. and in Iraq, and this was talking about the Persian Gulf War, I believe, of 1990-91, which is the war that, you know, everybody supported, like all the respectable people. It's fashionable not to support the Iraq War of 2003, but everybody, all respectable people, supported that earlier war. And she talked about the consequences that her family faced during that time.
Yeah, that's Dalia Wasfi's chapter, and that's one of my favorite stories in the book. She's an Iraqi American. She was born in Iraq, but grew up in the States, became a physician in the United States, but talks about her trips back to Iraq to visit family. And the story she tells about how they suffer from, you know, the economic sanctions, the occupation, the wars, it's just so disheartening. I mean, her poor family, and she really comes across her despair for them. Really comes across in the story. And there are lots of stories like that. And then on the other side of that, I was harken back to a little bit what you were saying earlier about the soldiers. There are several soldiers in the book, U.S. and soldiers from other armies, who discuss their experiences. And Ross Caputi talks about being at Fallujah in Iraq and just seeing the horrors there. And Alex Peterson talks about having detained Iraqis in his, you know, in custody, and talking to them and learning that they weren't, you know, Islamists who were hoping for jihad against the U.S., that they were engineers and other professionals who, you know, had their neighborhoods destroyed and their families killed and were trying to, you know, get the occupiers out. And it would totally realigned his whole idea of this war. He was trying to put himself in their shoes, and what would it be like if an occupying army came to his neighborhood and killed his wife? I love in the book the first account stories from the victims and the people who were assisting them and helping them.
Yeah, and in particular, because again, I'm just speaking from my own experience, but I know that as a young college Republican, I was not taught to think about that. I mean, and it's not that anybody came out and said to me, these people aren't even human. They're just garbage. And no one said that to me. But we all acted as if that was the case because no one ever cared. In the way that you would care if, let's say, or you'd pretend to care if there'd been an earthquake in Iraq. Well, everybody would be all tears and pity about that. You know, or, you know, if there had been some kind of terrible act of nature that had occurred, everybody, oh, terrible. Let's send international aid. But when people are having their limbs blown off in a war, that you're just not allowed to care. Nobody raises money to send and to help them. And in fact, one of the first voices to demand that some type of humanitarian relief be sent to Iraq was Pat Buchanan, which goes to show that the cartoon version of reality that we get in the media is so far from the truth. You know, when we're taught that the Hillary Clintons of the world are the real humanitarians, and somebody like Pat he hates people, he's a big hater, he's probably a Nazi, but yet he's the one saying these people should be fed and clothed and should get medicine, and the Clintons and the Bushes of the world just honest to goodness, just could not care less.
Yeah, I always wonder when you mention people like that, you know, whether they toss and turn at night. I don't know their motivations or how they deal with these decisions they make.
What surprised you in among all the contributions? Was there anyone that came in that you just gasped when you read it?
Yeah, certainly. It's my book, I know, but I've learned so much from the contributors to this book. And like you said, it's a big book. There's how many contributors are there? I forgot now. 70-something contributors. I just figured, you know, keep all the good stories in. It's more bang for your buck. But there was, you know, the stuff from before my time. Fred Brampton talks about Laos and how he was in Laos doing some humanitarian work back in the 60s, and the bombs started coming. There was nine years of bombing of these villages in Cambodia, and these people had no idea who was attacking them, why they were dropping bombs. They were hiding in caves for 9 years, losing family members on a daily basis. And, you know, Branfman actually testified to Robert Kennedy in the U.S. Senate about all the he interviewed 1,000 people in Laos, sorry. And the U.S. ambassador was testifying at the same time, saying that there is no bombing campaign going on in Laos. And Robert Kennedy said, well, you know, Fred, can you report, you know, and he tells, you know, everything he witnessed and everything that the people he interviewed witnessed. And then, you know, the U.S. ambassador Sullivan then says, you know, that's not true. None of this happened. And then Robert Kennedy turns to him and says, you know, I think you're lying. But what Branfman says is that it didn't change anything, that the federal government, well, really the executive branch of the federal government, was calling all the shots and Congress had no say. I mean, even you have the U.S., you know, a famous U.S. senator saying, I think you're lying, but can do nothing about it. You know, this continued for 9 more years and the bombs are still there. They're still in the ground. There are still people who will step on these bombs, you know, 50 years later and get, you know, lose limbs or die. So not that it's history from so long ago, but it, you know, I was born in the 70s. So a lot of the earlier generation stuff was more interesting to me.
Well, I note that there are pieces on war in general. There's a piece on counterinsurgency doctrine. There's stuff, as I say, on economics. I like the piece by David R. Henderson, who's also been a guest on the show, as it turns out. It's called something like George W. Bush Changed My Life, and what he means by that is that up to that time, he'd been an economist doing domestic policy, and that was how he spent his time. But after 9/11, particularly after the Iraq War, he felt like, wait a minute. You know, there are more important things than this. I have to speak out about this. I have to talk about this. And I'm going to take my talents and my insights as an economist, transfer them over to the study of international affairs. And he found that there had been not nearly as much economic analysis of, you know, political economy of war as there really should have been, as we ought to have expected. And so he began to pioneer in that, and he wrote a good piece for the Independent Review, for example, about why you don't actually need to go to war for oil. It does not make economic sense. He did a whole piece on that, and he did a whole piece on you know, why you would expect countries to be this destructive in their foreign policies. I mean, he took economic insights and he ran with them. And then eventually he got a column at antiwar.com, even though he wasn't a specialist in this area. He got a column dedicated to foreign policy. And the one time I had him on my show was to talk about non-intervention in foreign policy. So he said, that's how George W. Bush changed my life. He was so rotten that I had to pretty much drop what I was doing and adopt a whole new line of research because I felt morally compelled to do it. So that really impressed me. Then you've got pieces in here covering North Korea, Sudan, Afghanistan, Iraq, all kinds of specific places. There's a piece on Yugoslavia and the dissolution of Yugoslavia and what happened after that. It is, as I say, it is absolutely comprehensive. I'm really glad to see that you got a piece from Charles Goyette, who was that great radio host out of Phoenix, who was nationally syndicated He was, I believe, on he wasn't on satellite radio. He was on Clear Channel. And he was not going to be a cheerleader for the Iraq War. What you have in here are remarks he gave the very night the bombs started dropping in 2003. And everybody was beating the war drums. And he was expected to beat the war drums because he's a right-wing radio host. And he refused to do it. And he wound up losing his radio gig because of it. That's incredible. And it's great to read that.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, he stood on principle. You're right. He talks about how he lost his position because of it.
Yeah, there just are so few people who do stuff like that. You know, just the other day, I just made a new friend over the past couple of months, and he wound up getting a new job recently. And this job required him to do things that he just felt that morally he could not bring himself to do. And even though he had no immediate prospects, he simply quit the job. He had no other prospects, but he couldn't bring himself to do these things morally. And I think most of us, we can rationalize anything. Well, look, hey, I got to put food on the table and, you know, I got to do something or whatever. And somebody who just puts it all on the line and says, you know, I've got to stand for something. I have to be able to sleep at night. One way or another, I'll be okay. But I'm not going to be okay if I'm doing something that won't let me sleep at night, basically. So, all right, so did you self-publish this? How did this come out?
Yeah, I self-published it. So what I did was I contacted – I would read an article or hear an interview or read a story about someone, and I'd search the web and find them and contact them and ask if they wanted to contribute, and that got all the contributions, edited it, got someone to do the copy art and cover art and published it.
Yeah, there's a good piece in here that I liked just about the relationship between Lockheed Martin and the Pentagon, and it's called Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. So again, one of the things that you'll get in here is these are the sorts of things that we might say and speak in broad generalities. But here you've got the real nitty-gritty specifics, the facts to back up the – I don't want to say prejudices that we have, but the strong intuitions that we have about the way the world works are backed up very effectively in this book. So how many entries are there in here? I mean, would you estimate?
So, but on that chapter, Richard Cummings, he originally published that Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels and then updated it for the book. But you're right, that chapter is incredible because it thoroughly details all the cronyism of the military-industrial complex. I mean, it's amazing how much he exposes the inner workings and the open door policy. You know, how these guys go in between department positions to these positions in these corporations. So that's a fascinating chapter. I knew the solid number at one point, but there's about 70 contributors.
All right. Well, that's crazy.
78. There's 78 contributors from 34 countries from five continents.
All right. Come on now, people. Come on. I mean, how can you not want this thing? All right. Look, I think it's the trouble with it is I would need to almost have all these people on because I can't expect you to be able to speak for all these different people. But I wanted to highlight this book because I think it'll help a lot of people. I think it can change minds, but it's also good for people who are already with you to really be able to fill in the gaps in their knowledge and to have a really, really comprehensive overview of the war and peace issue, which is really central to the libertarian message. I mean, I know there have been a lot of people who've wanted to downplay that, but I think it really is, as Rothbard said, it really is the key question. Ultimately, that we have to be concerned with is war and peace, and it's just handled so comprehensively and beautifully by so many contributors of different points of view from different places in the world. So, how can people get this thing?
Well, I was going to say I could definitely put you in touch with any of these contributors that you'd like and have them on your show.
I've got like over 70 episodes right here.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, you've had a lot of them on already, but. One other thing that you mentioned this kind of at the beginning I wanted to mention was that it's not, you know, there are libertarians in this book and there are conservatives in the book. There's liberals in the book, but it's, there are definitely common grounds. I mean, most people will be, you know, against ending government wars, and they'll be for ending domestic unwarranted surveillance, and they'll be against suspension of habeas corpus, and you know, similar themes and topics that we can meet and we can all work together from, despite any differences we may have on other policies. And so I think this book does that. There, I have just as much appreciation of this book from left liberals as I do from libertarians and other people who are not politically affiliated. But this book's available in print and also in ebook through the iMac, iBooks, Kindle. It has pictures and links and videos on the ebook, and also there's the paperback copy you can get through Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other sites like that.
All right. Well, Mark, I appreciate your time today talking to us about it. It's really great. It's so well done. My audience will love it. You know, there's so many pieces you can't get into too much detail in any one of them. But the idea is that I want people to know that it exists because I just love it. And I think I'm so glad that you did it. I'm going to link to it so people can get it. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/658, which is the show notes page for today. Mark, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Yeah, the website's y-peace.com. Thanks
a lot. Oh, yeah. That's right. y-peace.com. I'm also going to link to that too. Yeah. That'll be up there too. y-peace.com. Definitely check that out as well. Okay, now for sure, I'll say thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All right, everybody. Well, the feed problem is more severe than I thought. Stitcher, God bless Stitcher. Stitcher is still getting all the episodes out. So, you know, we're still putting them out, and Stitcher's able to pick them up, so I don't know what iTunes' problem is, but it's a big, big, big problem. I got two of the best people in the business trying to fix it for me. I don't know what the heck went wrong. We haven't touched a thing. But at this point, the vast majority of people cannot get access to the episode. And then today, the podcast player on the site, on the individual show notes pages, went out. We haven't touched a thing. So I don't know what is happening, but I may hold off for a couple of days producing more. What's the point of producing episodes and getting them out there if only a small sliver of people are able to access them? And then all of a sudden there's going to be a big backlog of episodes that nobody will listen to. I think that does a disservice to me, to the guests I would have on. So I don't know what to do. I'm hopeful that within the next 24 hours we will manage to get this fixed. As I said, I'm working with the best possible people, and even they are stumped by the problem. So if you are one of the lucky ones who's able to hear me, I feel like it's you know, the end of the world, and I'm trying to see if there's anybody still alive out there. There may be a couple-day delay just as I try to figure out what in the world to do to get things up and running again. And one solution that's been proposed is we could totally redo your iTunes feed, but everybody who currently subscribes would have to resubscribe. No, I would rather see the world burn to the ground than implement that solution. So we're going to do the very best we can. Now, I have no technical knowledge, so I don't know what to do here. And the experts, as I say, are completely at a loss. But we're just doing the best we can. We'll see what happens. And if all goes well, you'll have another episode tomorrow. If not, you may have to wait a couple of days. But, you know, there's always Contra Krugman to hold you over. The recent episodes, as I say, are all on Stitcher. All right, well, sorry about this bad news. Thanks for listening, and I hope to be talking to you again very soon.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.